Call the meeting to order. Can we take a look at the meeting minutes from September 8th?
Diane, this is Jim Foster. I don't know if you can hear me, but you are really choppy unless this is on my end somehow.
You're very quiet. I don't hear any choppiness.
Pardon? I can't even. You know, let me try to log back in, see if I can figure out a different way to do this. So.
Okay.
Although I'm about 1 foot from my router, so it should be working, but let me see what's going on. I'll try to get back in.
Jim, okay. I can hear you perfectly, just so you know. Pardon? I can hear you perfectly.
Yeah, I'm must be on my end then for some reason. That's pretty weird.
I was going to move to approve, Diane.
Okay. I'll move to approve or second or whatever.
All right. So Julia first and John seconds. Okay. So any questions, revisions?
I don't have. I'm going to try to log back in. This is just not working. Okay.
Any public comments? Okay, Chairman's comments. All I have really is a reminder, the Human Services meeting is on 10/21 at 5 p.m. Jen, have you gotten anyone to attend?
Not that I've heard.
Okay. So can we do it virtually?
Yes, I believe it can be viewed virtually.
Okay. And they're going to be discussing the bylaws change?
I'm assuming the bylaws will come back up again at Human Service Committee, yes, because it got sent there.
If I can interject, that won't be discussed at our budget first, so that'll be pushed into November then.
Okay. So is there something that you want us to be answering questions on for that meeting?
If any Board of Health members want to attend, because they will be discussing the budget there too. Am I correct, John?
Yes, it'll just be the budget hearing. So that's what will be occurring. Okay. Certainly, you're welcome to attend. Just give us your name so that we can have you added in. And if you wanted to make comments, you can do that even beforehand by submitting those through email. And we'll go from there.
Okay, thank you. So anybody that wants to attend, please contact John or Jen. On to the budget. Denise.
You're muted, Denise.
It always helps if you unmute. Now, can everyone hear me? Awesome. And can you see my screen? I am currently sharing the cover page. All right. Yep. Terrific. Thank you, Will. I know you're out there for all your assistance in getting this set up. So today my job is to talk to you about our 2021 budget for the Division of Health. And we're going to start at the top. Very similar process that we've had in the past, same pages, same presentation. So I'm going to talk about the FTE changes, talk about the salaries and benefits line, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jen, and I'm going to share an org chart with you so that she can talk to you a little bit about a proposed reorganization for the Division of Health. Then we'll continue, go back to the rest of, you know, reviewing the rest of the expenses and revenue, and that will be how we process through the presentation. So starting at the top, you can see that last year's FTEs were 58.91 FTEs in the 2020 adopted budget. Our 2021 proposed FTEs are increasing by 1.79. We break the FTE numbers, we break the changes up into the things that happened in 2020 and then what is proposed for 2021. So there were a couple of changes, mostly or significant. The changes were in the home visiting program, specifically the parents as teachers side of that program. There were two open positions One was a nurse and one was a 0.5 mental health coordinator. We changed those two positions. The grant management decided to replace those positions as health strategists. So what that means is it's no longer a nurse that is performing the, or you know, acting in that role. They looked at replacing those positions with somebody with more of a childcare or early childhood background. They felt very strongly that they needed that. So although you see a reduction of one and a reduction of 0.5, it was basically a wash, and it is now 1.5 health strategists were hired in their place. And then for 2021, the biggest change that we have, and I'll talk about it more as we get through the expenses, but we increased substantially our KUSD nursing contract for the 2020-2021 school year. And as you can imagine, with opening the schools during a pandemic, it required a significant amount increase in the number of hours that the nurses are in the schools. So that's the 1.52 increase in that contract for 2021. And then we had one other increase of 0.2. We have an epidemiologist that's been on staff that was 0.8, or basically worked 4 days a week. And we are proposing replacing that position with a full-time FTE of 1.0, so an increase of 0.2 FTEs. So that explains the change from 2020 to 2021 in the number of FTEs. And the next section talks further about what did that result in dollars in the budget. And you can see the 2020 changes for those PAT home visiting positions was actually a net savings to PAT. The addition of the health strategist, they were actually a little less expensive than a nurse. So there was a resulting change, a decrease of about $38,000. And then the 2021 proposed modifications, so the increase in the KUSD school nurses, the hours that they're working, was about $168,000. And then the increase in the epidemiologist is about $21,000, $20,940. And then some additional changes, although it didn't impact dollars, there are some other changes that are proposed in the reorganization. For instance, we had a public health nurse position that's been open since February. It was somebody who retired, and we specifically left the position open. We are going to be using that position and changing it to a health supervisor position. So there's no FTE impact, and at this point, there's not much change in salary either. So it's sort of a wash in the budget, but we wanted to make sure that it was mentioned here. And then, so that's the third and fourth lines there, the 105,000. And then the all other increases basically in salaries for the budget was about $102,000. So that's your standard who's getting an increase over the year. For 2021, there's no change in the cost or expected cost or budgeted cost for health insurance. It's flat year over year. We have a small decrease, and that's just a change in the mix between somebody being family and single. So some of the new hires are actually either not taking insurance or are single instead of family. So we have a, you know, just a small change there. And then retirement is about $8,000 increase year over year. And basically everything else shakes out to about $6,000. So our total change in personnel is about $266,000. And like I said, most of that comes from that increase in the KUSD nursing contract, which has resulting revenue down below. So the personnel change, or the personnel portion of the budget, amounts to almost 69% of our total budget. So a little over $6 million out of $8.8 million in total expenses. And with that, I'm gonna let Jen talk to you a little bit more about these changes where I mentioned the FTEs. So I'm gonna page down to this org chart, and then I'm going to try, whoops.
Yes.
I'm going to make it bigger.
So thank you, Denise. When I first came in, there had been a previous study on what was functioning and what suggested improvements could happen with the structure of the health department. I spent a significant amount of time in those first 2 months before COVID took us away, but I had spent a significant amount of time looking at what was working, what was not. In a perfect world of time and money were no object, how would we function? Realigning some resources. For example, our staff and our programs were very siloed. And so in an effort to try to break down those silos, one example is that we have our public health nurses now learning other functions. So if before they were just an immunization nurse or just a clinic nurse, now they are learning potentially school nursing or the medically assisted treatment nursing or another aspect of nursing, so that we can deepen the bench in all of our functions, so that if we lose a staff member, there are other people that can pinch hit and sort of help out in those functions. So a lot of what you see here is sort of a deepening of the bench, breaking down of silos, more appropriately aligning things under our three branches, which the branches are population health. That's where a lot of our health education, health strategy, health strategists fall under, as well as our home visiting programs. Those fall under population health. Our clinic services has both of our two operating clinics at this time, plus school nursing, as well as our communicable disease arm. And then environmental health has the sanitarians, the lab, the lead program, and the POUTS program. So it was a little bit more of an alignment, and then you see fiscal off to the right there. It was a little bit more of alignment of where operationally things fit. Another component that you'll see on this slide, and hopefully you have that in front of you, is that we had titles that were all across the board and weren't congruent or consistent with their function, both what we had them identified within previous budget, but then what made sense nationally. So when we have staff go to conferences or speak of themselves, there are really accepted terms nationally in public health, like a public health strategist or a public health educator or a public health nurse. And so it was really an alignment of titles in order to make sure that we had consistency for hiring practices, consistency for job roles, job descriptions, and consistency with national best practice standards. So we have realigned the job titles. It resulted in no fiscal impact. It was more or less just making sure that in future market studies and things of that nature, that we can get a consistent apples to apples comparison based upon those job titles. So that is just a brief on the organization. Not major changes, but ways to make things more efficient, more streamlined, as well as providing a deeper bench there for services.
All right, are there any questions on the org chart? Sorry about that. I'm gonna bring it back up. I couldn't get it to reduce again. Okay, so where did you go? All right, so can everyone see my screen again?
Yep.
I just have to let you know that Supervisor Belsky is on. I'm sorry I'm joining late.
Thank you very much. Okay, so thank you, Jen, for sort of walking us through that organizational, some of the proposed changes for the 2021 budget. So I'm gonna pick up here at the contractual change section. And there's really only, you know, one number of significance here, and that's under other professional fees. We do have a reduction in costs, and that decrease is due to the removal of the Charter 26 cleanup costs. So the Division of Health, when those cleanups needed to take place, would normally contract with an outside service, and we do not have to do that and do not have to pay those payments. So I'm just sorry, I'm seeing an error message over here. Is everybody still seeing the screen? Okay, good. I don't know what it's saying then. so that is a reduction of about $12,000. And in total, We're down in this category in the contractual changes of about $13,000, little almost $14,000. All right, in the supplies category, we didn't have a lot of change, but some of the changes that I wanted to mention was were in lab and medical supplies. So we have a Narcan grant that we've had for about 4 or 5 years. I think we're in the fifth year of it coming now. And we increased the amount of Narcan that we're purchasing in this last leg of the grant. So that's the increase that you see there, about $15,000 or $14,500. That is for additional purchases of Narcan in that final year. Then we also, as we looked at the budget for 2021, we didn't know exactly what to expect with COVID and travel and staff development. So we did take a reduction in pretty much every area, making some assumptions that the first part of 2021, any staff development will be virtual. So you wouldn't have as many expenses for travel. So we have a decrease there of about $17,751. And then the other item would be in the other operating. And again, that is mostly related to Narcan and HUD. Again, two grants that we have. The Narcan grant, we specifically took some money out of other operating and we're moving it to the purchase of Narcan. And then in the HUD grant, you'll see that we have some expense reductions. It's in the final year of the three-year grant. So you've spent, you know, most of the funding has been, not most of it, but a lot of the funding has been spent in year one and year two. So in the final year, we don't have as high of expenses. We don't have as many properties to finish. So the projection or the budget reflects that. I'm not sure if everybody heard, but we did get renewed for the HUD grant. So just recently it was announced that we would have another three-year grant cycle. I think it's $4.4 million this time. So that's great news. That program will be continuing. Then the next section of expenses are referred to as fixed charges. And that's, you know, your insurance, your building rental, that type of thing. There's just a small change here. We now have two nurse practitioners that we're paying liability insurance for instead of one. So you can see an increase in the insurance line. And then in the building rental line, we are increasing our footprint at the WIC or RKCAA location in Uptown, and we anticipate we will have to pay additional rent for the larger space as well as some parking spaces there. So that's the increase you see under building rental. Under grants and contributions, as I mentioned, the biggest decrease here, $264,000, is the HUD grant. And again, that's just because we're in the last year of the grant cycle. It just means we don't have as many properties to purchase, or not purchase, but provide fixing for. And so therefore we'll spend a little less money. And then we also have a decrease in the WIC program. And that's related to the caseload at WIC. And I know that Pam's been working hard for the last several years to get more people enrolled in the program. Obviously, she's having a difficult time right now with things being remote and not being able to see their clients regularly. But that reduction in caseload is something that's occurring across the country. And I know all WIC programs are trying to get promotional materials out, advertise, that kind of thing, to make sure that people know about the services they offer. And then we have an increase in the lab just related to some additional assistance that we may need from a consultant or different things in the purchase service line. Under our outlay charges, we do have plans to purchase two pieces of equipment, the largest of which is a spectrometer for the lab. And I do have a little cheat sheet here because I don't pretend to understand all the equipment they have there. But the unit is called a spectrometer, and it is used for testing all of the controlled substances that come in. So say if a white powder comes in, they need to test it to see what's in it, and it tests it against all the different known substances. And the unit that we have now is about 15 years old, and the repairs are difficult, as well as parts are difficult to get to find and take care of. So we are hoping to replace that piece of equipment and bring us up to speed on our controlled substance testing. And then the last section of expenses relates to what we call interdivisional charges. And that's where the health department provides services to other human services organizations like Behavioral Treatment Court or DCFS. And an accounting practice, we had often been moving the cost between one line to another through a journal entry. And now we are, instead of doing a journal entry, we're just charging the other department directly. So say we have, if we get charged for tests from Wisconsin State Lab, we no longer book that to health and then move it through a journal entry over to the other division. We just charge them directly. So it's not really a change in expense. It's just that we're not flowing it through our P&L. That's why you see a change here from 2020 to 2021 of about $63,000 difference. It's sort of a change in the process. And that concludes the discussion of the major ups and downs in the expense budget. You can see in 2020, we had adopted $8,659,000. And in 2021, we're at $8,754,000 for a total increase of about 1.1%. Are there any questions on the expense portion?
Risk-based as well. So,
all right. So then we move on to the revenue portion of our budget. And we are projecting a slight decrease from 2020 in our revenue. And we'll walk through the different pieces of that as well. As I mentioned, the first item you see there is the bonding, and that is for the two pieces of equipment that we're proposing up in the expense line. So the plan is to bond for that, and they will be paid for through that process. Then we have our state consolidated contract, which includes things like public health preparedness, immunes, childhood lead, some of the standard programs that we have with the state. We are seeing a small increase in several of those, and that is what makes up the $47,000 increase year over year. The nurse family partnership, that reflects a slight decrease from 2020, but in fact, the funding is flat. The number for 2020 did not increase to $1,647,000, so we are remaining about the same year over year. Next is the Family Planning Reproduction Health, Reproductive Health Grant. We did get an increase in Title 10 in 2020. We got a little bit more money than we were anticipating, so I have included that in 2021. And that's the increase you see there of about 36,000. The decrease on the next line called nursing service fees, that is a decrease that we are seeing in our clinics. We have not had the same volume that we had. It's kind of been a sort of a steady decline over the last 2 or 3 years in immunizations and people coming through for STD services, things like that, where they pay us. This isn't Medicaid revenue. This is where they actually self-pay. So I did budget for a decrease there. I do know that there are lots of plans to turn this around, and certainly some of the things they're doing over at the WIC clinic where they want to increase the services and reach a bigger market over there. I do think we will hopefully turn this around and start seeing an increase there. And the next line is the WIC program, which I mentioned. We just, you know, we assume that the reduced caseload that we saw, the reduction in revenue we saw in 2020 will continue in 2021. Again, I know that they're, you know, doing what they can there to try and bump those case numbers, but that's all, it's a, you know, federal funding, and it's totally based on the number of people they're getting signed up and walking through the door. Then I mentioned the HUD grants already. So if you reduce the number of expenses we have, we will obviously reduce what we request reimbursement for. So it's a corresponding decrease in revenue. And then the Coverdell grant is a small grant that we have had for a number of years for our lab. Usually it helps to pay for some training for a chemist or maybe buy a small piece of equipment. And that grant next year, they've already told us that the dollar amount will be down a little bit. And then the next all other sources refers to fees and contracts. And in that line is the KUSD contract that I mentioned up above. We have a 1.52 increase in FTEs. This is a resulting revenue increase. And Jen and I were talking this morning, and she said there had been a question related to the KUSD contract. And I just wanted to address it, make sure that we covered it. So the KUSD contract, when the Maximus allocation process is completed, KUSD, that contract is not included on the city side or the city portion. And so if by chance next year in 2021, we don't renew that contract, it will not impact the city's portion, but it will impact the admin charges. Because if you pull out a program, you still have a pot of admin costs that need to be spread across all the programs. So the admin portion will get spread across a smaller number of programs. So there will be more admin across the board. And also I wanted to point out that KUSD, if it does not get renewed in 2021, that would not be in next year's calculation. It'd be 2 years from now. So that is our, you know, fairly large increase in the all other portion. The chemist salary, there's not much change there. And then the city contribution, you can see, went down again this year. It went down last year as well. And that is based on the 2019 Maximus cost allocation plan. So, you know, it's a calculation that goes through and determines the services and how they were applied and what residents received them. And there is a reduction in the city portion of about $112,000. If you shake that all out, that's about a $50,000 decrease, a little less than 1% in our revenues for 2021. And because our expenses went up and revenues went down, there is an increase in our county levy. So the county levy increase is about $146,000, or just under 12% increase.
Denise, this is Supervisor Belsky. Where are the other municipal or township contributions? I see the city has a contribution. What about the other municipalities?
We do not have any other contributions from other municipalities other than the city.
Why is that?
There's only, so when the city and county had separate health divisions, when they combined in 1992, that's created a contract on where the county, the city services got taken under the county. And under that contract, we charge the city for their portion. When we determine the city-county split, they get a credit for their taxes. So they don't get their full percentage of their, they only get the percentage above and beyond the taxes. The other municipalities pay their taxes and it's included in their taxes. So this is just a special agreement between the city and the county.
I would like a copy of that special agreement, yeah. Please.
Yeah.
And then also the grant that you go for, the grants that are awarded, is that based upon population count or is it based upon previous year usage? How does that work with the grants? Because a lot of our funding is based on outside sources, correct?
For the health department? Absolutely. Yes. In fact, I can show you the next slide is basically the makeup of our budget. And you're absolutely right. We have state grants of 1.8 million. Federal or other grants of another 1.7 million. So, you know, certainly a big, almost 41%. Actually, if you include the federal grants, you know, probably, let's see how much is that. That's like 55% of our budget is made up of grants. And each one is sort of has a different basis. The federal grant, that's the HUD grant that I talked about, as well as that small Coverdale grant. Those are specifically applied for. We have to do all kinds of, provide all kinds of information related to the population, the housing market, how many houses do we have that are, you know, before 1965, where there may be lead involved. So those grants, we have specific objectives in order to get them. the state consolidated contract, those grants have been awarded. I'm assuming most of them are based on the population of Kenosha versus the other locations, you know, the other counties in the state. And many of those have been exactly the same dollar amount or very nearly the same dollar amount for the last 10 or 15 years. That last bucket where it says other grants, that's the NFP program or the home visiting program is a big portion of that. And that again is based on when we first applied, it's a 10-year grant. So we haven't applied, we applied almost 3 years ago. I think we're in the fourth year of that grant. That was based on the clients we were trying to serve. And so you have to, you know, provide data on your population, the their income level and that kind of thing. So each one is a little bit different.
But, so I guess what I'm just seeing from an outside view is that a lot of the federal and state money, perhaps, and other grants that we're getting are largely based on the city of Kenosha population of 100,000. If we had just gone for the 60,000 countywide, chances are our grants would be much less. So this is where I'm very curious why the city of Kenosha would be paying almost $1 million in contribution when it is the city that is enabling us to get several of these federal and state grants. So I'm very interested in understanding that piece of it. And Tammy, when we meet, you, John, and I, I'd like to dive deeper into that to understand the agreement and why we're putting the burden on the city.
Yes, and just so you know, in the Maximus cost allocation, they do take revenue into effect as well. So, but we can go over in more detail later on this week when we meet for sure.
All right, thank you.
Okay, I have a question. This is Julia Robinson, for those of you who are on audio only. So when I came on board, one of the first questions I asked was about the Maximus plan, and that was when I discovered that it was being done by zip code, only the 5-digit zip code, which meant that areas of Summers, you know, when somebody came in and had one particular zip code, it was technically Summers, but it was being allocated and charged to the city. So have we figured out yet how to do the 5+4? Was the 2019 Maximus year the year that we did the 5+4 for the zip codes to more accurately allocate those charges? Or
we do not do the 5+4. The 4 is routing, has nothing to do with where they reside. What we do is our map division maps out all the addresses and gives us percentages. Now, we've done that for the last, I think since the year I started, was the first year we did that. So they actually look at the addresses and put it on the map and they say, okay, these ones are cities, these ones are county. So they are actually by address, street address, not zip code.
Okay, because when I came on the board, there was an issue with the fact that people would be at the clinic and they would sign in and they would put the whole address down, but the zip code was Summers, but it was being put as city. So you're telling me that this is the year, and I kept getting told that one year it was going to, they were going to be changing things. So the 19 was the year that we changed it to
This is the third year that we use the street address.
I'm just wanting to make sure that we're using the detailed one and not the old pattern. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. This is Diane Gerlach. I just have a question on clinic volume. Mm-hmm. Where do we see that coming from? Is it more people are insured, fewer people are seeking care, the healthcare systems are providing more? Where do we think that's coming from?
So, Denise, maybe you want to talk a little bit about insurance versus non, but when I was first shown the numbers and how our revenue in our clinics has been going down, it does appear quite alarming. I think there could be better marketing, better management to be able to, and that was part of the reorg, is how do we reach the populations that need our clinic services better? So So for example, the wellness center, which is above, it's in the RKCAA building, above WIC, was a one nurse clinic. Out west of the eye clinic was a one nurse clinic. So the amount of services that could be provided by one nurse was very minimal. So that's part of us enhancing and making, for example, the wellness center more robust. It will eventually have four people out there, can provide many more services, services that were previously only provided at the job center clinic. And so I do project that our revenue for our clinic services will go up because we're going to have business plans for how we can work much harder at marketing and getting to the people that need our services and being in the neighborhood to supply to those people.
Because I'm looking at, with COVID, there's a lot of people that are still without jobs and a lot of businesses that are probably going to be shutting down completely. So the unemployment and people needing services is probably going to go up within this next year.
Right. And I think the clinic, like I said, it has been a gradual decline. I do for sure think that people getting getting insurance and having a primary care provider, I do think that impacted us. You know, one of the lines that has decreased dramatically is immunizations. Well, they are probably going elsewhere to get those immunizations instead of coming to the health department. So I think that has had an impact, and you know, maybe we're going to see a change in that in 20, you know, years.
I think most of your PEDS clinics are doing the vaccines for children. So, and the insurance companies are paying for the vaccines. So that's probably where you're getting all of the decrease there.
Right. And then certainly we, the volume of immunes where people are paying for it is often undocumented individuals where they're paying cash. And we're also seeing a decrease in that because I think the kids are getting covered. Let's see. So I believe we are down to, so the final slides relate to our clinic service fee schedule, and we do review those costs every year. I also update, we look at the federal poverty level. So that scale is updated every year with, you know, if you are at a certain level, here is what our sliding fee scale requests that you make payment for. And you can see the prices did not increase from 2020 to 2021. We are still charging the same for an immune. If you're in the VFC program, we're looking at $15. For adult flu, we're looking at $35. Some of the places that I know we've seen a decline, for instance, in adult flu, because we don't buy a large volume, we're paying more for every one of those immunes than, say, Walgreens or CVS. And so people can go there instead and get those immunizations. So that is certainly, you know, impacting our revenue as well. The other items on here, like I said, the pregnancy test, TB skin tests, we have not changed any of those prices. This second segment still holds the federal poverty level limits up at the top, and then it has some of the charges for our family planning reproductive services like depo, IUDs, nexplanon removal. One area that we have seen an increase in over the last 2 years is in Medicare revenue for, I'm sorry, Medicaid revenue for family planning. So our previous nurse practitioner was providing more of these services, and we have seen an increase in that in the Medicare paid revenue. And so that has been nice, sort of a steady increase for the last 2 years. And now that we have two nurse practitioners on board, I would hope to see that continue. And then the last section of the sliding fee scale is our laboratory fees. So we do a very large volume of water testing. Many people come in and get their wells tested, their water. We do spore testing and radon kits, and that is the last segment. So that is the 2021 budget. Is there any other questions that anyone has?
I would just like to thank you, Denise and Tammy. Thank you so much for all the work you put into this.
This is Rita. Tom, this question's probably more for you, but do you anticipate the school contract to continue with KUSD, or do you think this was really more interim because of COVID issues?
So in the past, it has been a 5-year contract. We did a 1-year contract this year just because of COVID and the uniqueness, and we had to modify the contract because of what our nurses would be doing in the schools this year. So they will be submitting a request for proposal in March for the next 5-year go around.
Okay.
Any other questions? Can we have a motion to approve?
Mrs. Mark, I'll move to approve.
Do we have a second?
This is Rita, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so passed. So thank you for all the work on that and for everybody sticking it out and reviewing it. Now on to the health officer report.
All right, so just some brief updates about COVID, because what else is there, right? COVID is still all consuming, all hands on deck, with especially 12 districts in the county and all being back face to face. There have been, with colleges and universities, I'm not trying to throw blame at who's responsible for increasing cases. It takes all of us. But there has been a great increase in cases over the last few weeks. Resources really going into diversifying how we're doing contact tracing, following a crisis standards of care, because we cannot necessarily keep up if the volume keeps up at this rate. When we get over 20 to 30 cases in a day, that's when our resources in the health department are maxed, and we're getting 50 cases a day now. So with that, we're trying constantly quality process improvement, trying to create efficiencies in how we're doing disease investigation, contact tracing, working with our regional partners, and how we can keep best practice learning and what we can do better, sharing resources and that sort of thing. We have an increase in testing capacity with the National Guard now being in our county twice a week until December 10th when they get pulled back federally. We have other partners such as Modern Apothecary, who will soon be coming on board to be able to offer COVID testing. That's a pharmacy. And some other partners you will hear about soon. Our hospitalizations are slightly up at 18 hospitalizations, 2 on ventilators for the county. So we are not near capacity like you hear in northern parts of the state where their hospitals are at 195 to 105% capacity. We are not at that capacity yet. I think largely for Kenosha County, the capacity will come into play with staffing levels more so than bed and ventilator levels for our county. And this coming weekend, our Wisconsin Electronic Disease Surveillance System will be down. The state is doing a statewide upgrade, which is desperately needed. It's been problematic throughout this whole pandemic because it was never built for this large of a communicable disease. So that is going down this weekend, meaning we won't be able to see any lab results or notify any positives this weekend. It'll put us in a bit of a backlog next week, so we're preparing for that. And then, of course, flu season, encouraging everybody to get their flu shots, working on that with our school children, and trying to plan for 2021. Now, we're figuring out, we have a call tomorrow that tells us the part of COVID money that we're getting in 2021 to learn what we can spend that on. And so it's a bit of an unknown right now what will happen after December 31st. If we can keep on the large numbers of disease investigators and contact tracers that we've now hired and trained to help us, and we hope we can keep them on afterward. Otherwise, I'm not quite sure how we will respond to COVID in 2021. Vaccination planning is also happening. We are working on the logistics of how could that happen as far as drive-through vaccination. There's inherent issues with that, but we also don't want to bring a large body of people into an indoor space. And how with the limited amounts that we'll begin that we will receive at the beginning, who will get that vaccine. There's a state ethics committee that's still in an open comment period for the next 2 days as far as who gets the first doses of vaccine that will get into the state. So there's a whole lot of planning going on as far as funding, testing strategy, disease investigation, contact tracing strategy, vaccine strategy, and yeah, that's about enough on that. So as far as our programs, you heard Denise say, we received the HUD grant, which is great news. We'll be able to move forward with that and looking for some healthy home improvement in that realm. Our home visiting teams have been able to get back into their clients, not necessarily their homes, doing more telehealth to pick back up those services. Our clinics are, while still operating on an appointment schedule, which is not ideal, we want to get back to the walk-in ability, but with COVID, our resources for our clinics are strapped, but we are obviously opening up services and trying to get back to our community, all of our other public health duties as well too. So lots of changes as we're trying to get back to, you know, continuity of operations, previous public health operations, but we're still in incident command for COVID. I don't know how that is going to end because at some point COVID has to become part of the regular, you know, just like a program or routine, just like we deal with other communicable diseases. It cannot sustain this way forever. And our staff are showing wear. So that is where we sit with COVID versus all of our other regular duties.
All right, thank you.
Julia had a question, I think.
Yes, I did. Real quick, what is our R-naught right now?
Oh, I don't have it to date. It was at Friday, it was just below one, which we had to triple look at that because we thought, how did we get below one when our percent positivity rate is still so very high? We're above 20%, and it's not because there's lack of testing. So that's a bit alarming for us that our percent positive rate is so high when we have plenty of testing going on right now as well.
Okay, so what is our percent positivity right now, or is that just the most recent?
Well, 21% is the 7-day rolling average, 22% is the 14-day average. It depends on how you slice the data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks. For a long time, we were very high in our asymptomatic positives. Is that still going on?
We're still at 22% asymptomatic positives. So that's been pretty consistent since about May. We hit about 25% at one point, but 22% is where we're at right now for asymptomatic positives. And quite honestly, we're still seeing a close to a 20% non-compliance rate with people that maybe aren't letting us know where all they've been. So, you know, containment of the virus is completely out. We're really in a harm reduction mode to be able to try to reduce the harm as much as possible. Still visiting 100% of businesses that we receive information about and doing education, lots of time being spent with schools, lots of time being spent with businesses, and just that broader education for the community. And the masking mandate was upheld. So that is a very good, helpful thing that we want to keep encouraging is the masking.
John, what about education with churches, since they are not, you know, under the same restrictions per number of people? Are you doing any education with them and encouraging the mask mandate with them?
Yeah, I mean, early on when the Kickstart plan came out, there was a special group that we were meeting with for that. Whenever they reach out or if we get resident concerns, we're going out and doing education with them. But yeah, there could be more. And so trying to encourage all those COVID measures, not just masks, with those entities.
Another question that I have is about how we are working with school systems. So for instance, I know of a situation where as part of this 20% non-compliance, they told the contact tracer, there was a child who was positive. They told the contact tracer that the child had been in virtual school. The child had actually been in physical school. And it took several days to sort that out. are we doing anything where, for instance, does KUSD or do, you know, Freedons or, you know, Shoreland or, you know, any of the, I don't want to name names, but, you know, do any of these schools, do we communicate to the school this child was at your school or is a known positive? How are we doing this?
Yeah, so the schools, first of all, have been amazing, amazing public health partners. We've been meeting with them weekly since early June to get them ready for this, to give them, answer all the questions, get them PPE, do whatever we could. We provided templates and forms and letters and everything to help ease their job. What happens is, and it can happen one of two ways. We see the lab results, so we start our disease investigation process on a positive. If they state that they have been in school, we call the school, and they are really helping us with the line list as far as gathering who was in the classroom. We're also having parents that get their results faster than they come into our system, so they're calling the school. The school calls us to confirm. Of course, we don't act on anything unless we have the lab result in front of us. We don't want to make a decision to quarantine a classroom if we do not know for sure that that person is positive. So we wait for that disease investigation to get done so that we can identify their infectious period, which gives us their isolation and quarantine dates for their close contacts. And so we've been working with the schools very in depth, every single case. It takes a lot of resources. KUSD is hiring 3 contact tracers. We're training them next week. And so that they will not only be able to help us with the line list creation, but with actual contact tracing within the KUSD system. And that is excellent because we're not in the schools. So we are heavily relying on the schools to tell us Johnny is in, you know, third grade and he also plays this after school sport. And, you know, so that we don't necessarily know that the parents or the family may not always be able to tell us all the exact names of who their child was next to or close to, and especially phone numbers and contact information. So that is how, you know, it comes from a variety of different ways there.
Julie, I just want to add, this is Sherry, I want to just add to what Jen just was saying. So initially when the schools opened, we realized that we may tell a positive person that you have children and you know, don't send them to school, but they weren't necessarily abiding by that. So now what we're doing is we're also giving a list of positive students to the schools so that they can watch for those children also. And we've caught a few families trying to send the children in and those kids have been sent back home. So just so that you know, we have looked into that and we're taking care of that.
Great. Thank you. I think that was probably one of the situations that I was made aware of was a child who went back. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jen, this is Laura Belsky. Is it practice for the fire department and one of the guys is positive, after their 10-day time, they can just automatically go back to work?
So fire department is an essential personnel, according to the CDC. The question has a couple different tentacles.
Let me give you the exact, okay? The exact is my son was tested positive and we wanted to see our grandkids. We couldn't see him. We told him, he said, well, I'm going back to after my 10 days. I was told to come back. And I said, well, I want you to get tested again. He was tested positive 2 days before he went back to work. And they said, well, as you're within the 10-day period. But now my kids have been out of school. My grandkids have been out of school. They'll be out of school for another 10 days after he went back to work. So it's all very confusing.
It is very confusing. So testing again is not necessarily recommended because a person can still test positive for a month or more out. That doesn't mean they're infectious any longer. So the quarantine for children starts if they can't isolate themselves within a household. The children, for example, in this case, the quarantine starts after the infectious period of the positive in the household. So yeah, it places some children out for a much longer time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
And that has been a huge concern. you know, not only do the guidelines keep changing, but it is very confusing to try to convey this to the general population and the parents. I mean, we are taking several parent phone calls. I know each of the districts are taking several parent phone calls, and it is, it's very confusing. Quarantine dates can change because if another positive comes into the household, that shifts everybody else's dates out, and it's not an easy thing to understand.
Are there any resources to support a family that may have a child with positive COVID test, and then now she has to adjust her working schedule? I know Salvation Army received some money to help with rental assistance, but is there anything else out there? I guess my concern is just, you know, kids being positive, and now mom, dad has to take off work, and then that leads to not being able to make rent payments.
So several, from food to financial resources, are listed on the County Hub website. So anytime we get new wind of a new grant or anything, we place that out there that people can reach out to the variety of resources that they might need. 211 is also a great resource to help with whatever assistance may be available out there. Good question.
Anything else? So thank you, Jen. Move on to corporate council report.
Okay, just to try and be brief, in terms of our office's interaction with health department, we've been continuing to work on public record requests, which have been coming in with a fair amount of consistency over time from mostly media outlets. So obviously that involves, most of it's related to the coronavirus outbreak. And so there's a lot of lenses through which we have to look at the desired material that is part of a response to redact. So we've been working on those consistently, and I have one now that I'm still working on. I know that Jen Freiheit and I did a little bit of outreach relating to the bylaws to try and answer any questions about those and assist in understanding the changes. And other than that, discussions with the health department on policy issues and just answering some questions relating to policy that we have with the health department. Those are the main things that have happened from Corp Council's perspective, interacting with health department.
All right, thank you. Any other business? Any other board comments? Then, yes? All right. Then can we have a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Thanks everybody for joining us.